Scripture lesson for this morning's message comes from the Gospel according to John. I'll be reading from the 18th chapter, beginning verse 33 through verse 37. Then Pilate entered the headquarters again, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you ask this on your own, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate replied, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests have handed you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." Pilate asked him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "Well, you say that I'm a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. I can sort of sympathize, if I'm honest, with Pilate here in this text, because I know how uneasy I feel when someone starts telling me that they know the truth. I start looking for the exits. I'm not objecting to honesty, which is a noble, high virtue, but that's not usually what people are talking about when they say in a certain way, "I know the truth." That's often the opening line of many a conspiracy theory, sometimes filled with alternative facts, you might say. So my first thought to myself is usually, "Uh-oh, what am I about to get myself into here in this conversation?" So if Pilate's life experiences were anything like our life experiences, I think if we look at it honestly, we can understand why he took on a cynical view. But as we look more closely at the exchange between Pilate and Jesus, we can see the two were kind of talking right past each other. They weren't really talking about the same thing. Now, one of the charges that had been brought against Jesus was that he claimed to be a king of the Jews. Actually, we have no record that Jesus ever made that claim, but rather others said it about him. Even as early as the time of his birth, the Magi came asking, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews?" in Matthew chapter 2. At the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, when he called Nathanael to be a disciple, Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel," in John 1. And as recently as a few days before his arrest, as Jesus rode on a donkey into Jerusalem, the crowds welcomed him and they were shouting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord," in Luke chapter 19. The Jews, however, it's important to note, were not a free people. So they had no political right, you see, to claim their own king. Palestine was a province of the Roman Empire, and for anybody other than Caesar to rise up and declare themselves to be king or ruler would be perceived by the Romans as a threat to their own rule. So Governor Pilate, as the local representative of Rome, had to be concerned about anyone rumored even to have made such a claim. So his first question to Jesus, likely in chains right before him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Pilate wants to determine whether the prisoner, in this case Jesus, is a threat to the state. There follows an exchange where Jesus asks whether Pilate is really concerned that he's a threat or whether someone, meaning the religious authorities, is manipulating Pilate, the governor here. Eventually, though, Jesus answers Pilate's question by saying, "My kingdom is not of this world." And Pilate responds, "So you are a king," missing altogether that Jesus is defining king and kingdom differently from how the empire of Rome views it. Jesus' answer, "You say that I'm a king," tells Pilate that his understanding of kingship isn't really adequate to describe Jesus' role, which Jesus goes on to explain, as we read, "For this I was born, for this I came into this world to testify to the truth." Everyone who belongs to the truth, he went on to say, listens to my voice. And this then led Pilate to a rather mocking reply. Did you catch it? What is truth? Pilate understood enough of what Jesus said to realize that the prisoner was no danger to Rome, but the governor did not get on board with the rest of what Jesus said, that his sovereignty, the realm, if you will, to which his kingship applied, wasn't a geographical location, nor was it a certain tribe or group of people born of a certain lineage, but rather a servant, a messenger, a king to truth itself. In fact, earlier in John's gospel, Jesus is quoted as having identified himself as truth, telling his disciples, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And here with Pilate, Jesus says that truth is something to which everyone who listens to him can belong. Now, I want you to think about that. I find it significant that Jesus chooses the word belong, which implies that truth possesses us rather than a word like corner, which would imply that we could get the corner on the market on truth or possess truth for ourselves. Jesus could have said, "Everyone who corners the truth listens to my voice," but he didn't say that. And I think that is why I am so bothered by people who advertise, "We've got the truth. Our group is the true group." You see the difference between belonging to the truth and assuming you can own it or corner it. Consider with me just for a moment three basic tests of truth that classical philosophy offers. The first is what is known as the correspondence theory. That is, that truth is the agreement between a statement of fact and an actual fact. For example, if someone sells you a device for your car, I'm sure we would all love this, that claims to double your gas mileage, but after being installed it makes absolutely no difference as you test the MPGs, then there is no correspondence between the claim and the reality, and thus you can conclude that the claim is not the truth. So the correspondence theory has significant limitations, however, as a truth test, because many situations offer no opportunity to check a claim against a fact. If, for example, someone says, "You will go to heaven if you follow Jesus," there is no way to verify that by correspondence, since in life we have no access to the fact of heaven. The second classical truth test in classical philosophy is the coherence theory. In other words, something is true, coherence theory says, if it is consistent with other judgments already accepted to be true. For example, if I say, "Now, if you play with fire, what? You'll get burned." You likely accept that as true because it in no way contradicts your previous experience with fire, particularly those of us who like to cook on open flames a lot, probably more than we should. But there are limitations to the coherence theory. If your initial system of judgments is incorrect, new errors could be consistent with the errors in that whole system. So if you start out with the assumption, for example, that the white race is superior to all other races, and then you hear of a black person who does something dumb, that does not contradict your racist presumptions. But that does not make your racist view correct, does it? You started out with a flawed system of ideas and you were looking for things to validate it. The third classical truth test in classical philosophy is pragmatic theory, that truth is what works or whatever gives satisfactory results. Does this sound like some of us? We're pragmatic people, some of us. I tend to find myself easily grouped in here. But some beliefs may work for a while, only to be shown unworkable later. For example, in an earlier time, burning people to death as witches may have freed some people from certain fears. So in that sense, it worked. But it would not work today. and we know it's not the way that we should treat each other. All three of these tests are helpful in making decisions when we weigh them all out about what could be true, but as we've noted, all three have limitations, and answers of unshakable certainty will continue to elude us. Now, another way to think about truth is to consider what truth is not. For starters, truth is not a majority opinion, contrary to popular belief. While this may seem obvious, consider how often we accept something as true simply because it seems to be believed by the most people, at least the most people that we know. But the majority can easily be wrong. For one time, most people believed that the world was flat. Another way to think about what truth is not is to consider that truth is not an edict. It's not a command, whether it's from the president of any country or the national leadership of a church or a bishop or a pastor in a town or the smallest individual in the world. No matter how noble any of these sources might be, they cannot guarantee their decision will be the truth just because they proclaim it and say it. In the 17th century, Galileo was hauled before the church inquisition because he made this wild claim that the sun, not the earth, was the center of the universe. He was forced to recant, but that did not change the truth of his scientific assertion, and in 1993, just a few years later, the Vatican officially, though belatedly, affirmed the validity of his work, even though they led to his demise over it. Truth is not something we can just sense either. Many people have said, you know, I can just tell when someone is lying, and maybe sometimes we can, only to discover later that we might have been wrong. Our instincts can be conditioned by lots of things in our environments and our upbringings, and they can be very unreliable, actually, when it comes to guiding us to the truth. Now, this one, I tried to reason this out, and you'll have to ask me about it later. I don't have more time to go into it. But truth is not pure logic or reason either. Logic declares, for example, that it would be mathematically impossible for any of you to leave this church building today. And don't get nervous. We're going to let you. How in the world could this be logical? Well, it depends on how you set up the rules by which you measure logic. Of course, if I said this to you this way, well, logically, before you reach the door to get out of the church today, you have to cover half of the distance. And then you have to cover half of the remaining distance, and then half of that remaining distance, and then half of that remaining distance, and so on. It'd never reach the door. I mean, if you could measure it down to the millimeter. So reason and logic can point towards ultimate truth, but they cannot take us all the way to truth if there's a faulty premise on which the logic is set up. Now, truth is also not enthusiastic sincerity. Maybe you heard about the time a church janitor, when cleaning the pulpit area after a Sunday service, found the preacher's notes. The preacher had noted a comment over in the margin of the notes, "Argument weak here. Better holler." Do you get it? Hello? Are you awake? Okay, I can't help you. Truth is not a deposit of knowledge either. So we have more knowledge than ever today. And thanks to the internet and other technology and better access, we have better access to knowledge than ever. So in many places, a part of that knowledge contradicts other parts of knowledge. But even when it doesn't always yield final answers, because the body of knowledge is wonderfully useful and helpful, but it cannot ever be all there is to the truth. And finally, truth is not certainty. People who declare they have a corner on the truth are usually very certain about their claims, but they are almost always certainly wrong. Perhaps then Pilate asked the wrong question. Instead of "what is truth," maybe he would have been better off to ask, "who is truth?" And to that Jesus responds, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life." Our faith says that God is ultimate reality, ultimate truth. And for Christians, Jesus was the ultimate expression of truth that leads us towards God. So the question, "what is truth?" comes from a seeking mind, but the answer is only found by a seeking heart. For God cannot be grasped by the gropings of our minds, but God can only be experienced by people of faith who, through the depth of our commitment to love of God and love of neighbor, endeavor to experience truth in action by way of love. I read this past week about a true story. It happened some years ago in Youngstown, Ohio, at a local congregation, the Trinity United Methodist Church. There was a custodian named Katie Johnson, you see, and she'd held the position of custodian at Trinity United Methodist Church for more than 40 years. 40, that's a long time. And the church had had a policy in place that provided a pension for longtime employees when they retired. The policy, however, specified that the person needed to be 65 years of age in order to receive the pension. And when Katie said she was ready to retire, there arose a bit of a problem. You see, Katie was a black woman who had been born to sharecropper parents in the Deep South back in days when some county governments did not bother to record births of black children. Consequently, Katie had no birth certificate. She had no proof of her birth date. In fact, she was not absolutely sure how old she was, though it was likely she was at the least 65 years of age. In any case, without a birth certificate, the church trustees who oversaw the pension plan were in a bit of a quandary at first about what to do. But it was all solved really quickly when one of the trustees did the following. When called upon, he said, "Katie has earned this pension, and we want her to have it. So I move that for purposes of retirement, Katie Johnson, as far as we're concerned, is 65 years old." And another trustee immediately seconded the motion, and then the affirmative vote that followed was unanimous. Katie retired. She received the pension for which she had worked all of these years faithfully for the church, along with a party, a celebration in her honor, just as it should have been. Now, you could certainly argue that the trustee's action did not establish truth in the absolute sense regarding her age, and you'd be right. But I would maintain that their action was the loving, Christian, most truthful thing they could have done. They were not saying that they had a corner on truth, because really, who knew exactly how old Katie was? She didn't even know. But their actions belonged to the truth. It was something that Jesus would have done. It was kingdom kind of behavior. So likewise, we here who act in love belong to the truth. Truth is not something we can ever own or have the corner on the market for, but we belong to the truth when we live out the high calling of love. We will not find truth by going deeper into our heads, but by living out the love that is already in our hearts. Truth, you see, is not something we can ever manufacture in theory up here in our brains, but rather truth is something we discover by living it out in practice. The world does not need one more theory, one more notion of what truth is, one more hypothesis, but the world is starving for true love. And when we love, we belong to the truth. And when we belong to the truth, we no longer have the burning desire to prove others wrong and proclaim our own rightness, but instead we love others from a place of calm assurance, because we know that the highest expression of what we say we believe to be the truth is how we treat each other, every single other. What is truth? Shh. Don't tell me. Show me. Amen.